Rise. The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Gaitas, Judge Johnson, Judge Larson, the Honorable Theodora Gaitas presiding.
Good morning, everyone. You may be seated. Welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. Today is May 10th, 2023. And we have three cases on our calendar. Two of them are scheduled for oral argument. And it looks like we are all ready to go with the first case on our calendar. I will just note we have some observers in the courtroom today as well from Two Rivers High School. Welcome to you. The first case on the calendar is ROA Inc. versus St. Louis County, State of Minnesota, and Elbow Lake Manor Property Owners Association. And the case number is A221784. Just a few words to counsel before you begin your arguments this morning. I ask that you use the lectern in the center of the room to make your presentations. Appellant will have 15 minutes to argue. Respondent will then have 15 minutes to argue. And it's my understanding that just one of the attorneys for one of the parties will be making the argument. And I see you're nodding your head. And then appellant will have a five-minute rebuttal. Before you begin your arguments, please do identify the your name and the party you're representing. And you'll see when you get up to the lectern that your time will be counted down for you. Please be mindful of your time as well. That concludes my comments. Are you ready to go?
Yes, Your Honor.
All right, you may proceed.
If it pleases the court, Joel Holstead speaking for ROA today. It is a privilege to be able to represent ROA in front of this body. I have not involved in the briefing of this matter. I was asked to make oral arguments because of my prior experience in the real estate conveyancing industry. Before admission to the bar, I spent 40 years as a real estate title examiner and have dealt very significantly and frequently with the very issues that are represented by this case. But before we talk about the problems with the statutory regime that Minnesota deploys in order to collect real estate taxes and subsequently occasionally profit from that, it should be noted that this particular incident isn't about collecting property taxes. ROA has fully paid the taxes into the court or into the county, so the only issue really in dispute here is whether or not title is able to vest in the state to facilitate the state to profit from the resale of the property, or whether or not the state is obligated to acknowledge the fact that taxes have been collected. And I want to repeat that, yes, the taxes are fully paid on this property. There is no claim for unpaid taxes in this particular matter. In the 40 years of title examination, prior to my admission to law school and admission to the bar, we frequently ran into title exam issues dealing with property that was tax forfeited. It results in what our brief refers to as Title Standard 45. Title Standard 45 guides title examining attorneys as to how to deal with forfeiture. And as the respondent has acknowledged, the title standard is not dispositive. It's not a governing or controlling authority. But it's a guide that knowledgeable real estate attorneys have used to indicate how best to make determinations of title that provide safe title for the purchasers that do not require subsequent title clearing action. Absent acknowledging the caveats that are acknowledged in Title Standard 45, as a title industry, we were frequently required any time being asked to convey or insure tax forfeited title, title that was processed according to statute, as the respondent argues here. The title industry will require either quiet title action or quitclaim deeds from the adjoining parties, specifically to address the deficiencies in the notice provisions that the current Minnesota statute and the prior statutes provide. As our brief noted, in the earlier versions of Title Standard 45, the caveat case was abscess, which significantly acknowledges that the statutory scheme at that time has defects in the notice requirements, notice being a critical element in protecting the due process rights of property owners, which is not protected by statute. Subsequent to the version of Title Standard 45 cited in our case, an update to Title Standard 45 makes reference to a more controlling case, which is the Mennonite Board of Missions versus Adams, which is a U.S. Supreme Court decision, which Just briefly, and I apologize for having to read this, my eyes aren't that good and neither is my memory. Notice by means as certain to ensure actual notice is the minimum constitutional precondition to proceeding with process which will adversely affect liberty or property. It's important to note here that the U.S. Supreme Court has said that actual notice is required, not just the pretense of notice that our rules of civil procedure and Minnesota Statute 284 provide for. Let's talk about the
Just one moment. Before you move on, isn't really the threshold question in this case whether the action is time-barred under 284-28?
I disagree with that assertion, Your Honor, because the time threshold argument is predicated on the assumption that notice was given. You can only have a time limitation to respond to an action that you know that exists. If a party does not know of an action, it does not know that an action, the two time bar elements of the foreclosure regime require notice prior to the forfeiture and notice prior to the notice of expiration of the regime. You have time limitations, which we concede the state has the authority to place limitations on time to respond to an action, but you can only respond to an action that you know exists. And in our argument is that the time statute, the time limitations to file an action cannot be based on a start time based on a pretense of notice rather than an actual notice. If ROA had been actually notified of the action and had been late in its filing, we wouldn't be here today. The issue is that ROA was not notified in an actual sense. The only notice that ROA had of the action is based on the publication provision and the attempted mailing, which the respondent knows was returned as not delivered. So the respondent had actual knowledge that ROA was not notified of the process, and yet is attempting to hold them liable to the statutory provision of a time response provision, which presumes that notice had been provided. So I'm arguing that no, the notice provision, though, is the central argument. The notice provision presumes that notice has actually been provided, which in this case we know that notice was not provided.
Mr. Holstead,
yes, sir.
The 1 year period is measured from what date or what event?
The one year period, I believe, is from the period of the issuance of the certificate.
And again, that's in subdivision. Can you remind me of the subdivision?
I believe that's 284 subdivision 3.
.28. It looks like 1 year after the filing of the proof of service of the auditor's notice of expiration of the time for redemption?
Yes, and the proof of service is the key issue there, because proof of service under the statute isn't required to be actual notice. You can affect service under the tax forfeiture regime in manners that our civil procedure would not presume. The language of the statute actually does say you need to serve by certified mail, but it has language that says that the lack of service is not failure of the certificate, which means service is not required. And there's the fallback provision that the auditor relies on in this particular case, which says that you can notice by publish. But when we go back to the Supreme Court, I had mentioned already Mennonite Board, but Mennonite Board also relies heavily on a prior case involving Murnan, where the Supreme Court found, and I apologize, I'm not having that in front of me, where the Supreme Court found that the pretense of published notice is not sufficient to create actual notice, and that's the case upon which the Mennonite says that actual notice is required. And in the underlying cases that Title Standard 45 and the Murnan case are built on, it was an analogous situation in Indiana, where they had a provision for published notice to act as the placeholder for service, which our rules of civil procedure provide. But as this court knows, our rules of civil procedure only allow publication of notice for parties that are out of state or all remedy of contact have been exhausted. In this particular case, it was known where ROA resided. We have no explanation for why the mail was returned as not delivered, but we know where he resided and no subsequent attempt to deliver.
Can I interrupt just because I think, so like Judge Gaetis, I'm trying to make a distinction between issues that have to do with, all the process,
yes,
the lease or the forfeiture and the conveyance of title and so on, and then the other hand, issues related to the one-year statute of limitations. And I feel like you have most of what you're talking about is the first category of issues, which I'm sure is very more complicated than the second category of issues, which is the issue on which the district court dismissed the action. So How do you get around the fact that there was a filing of proof of service of the auditor's notice of expiration of the time for redemption, and your action was commenced more than 1 year after that?
Because the statutory proof of service, Your Honor, simply says that you attempted to mail. There's no actual requirement.
Well, you're challenging the procedures, the underlying procedures, not the statute of limitations.
Because the statute of limitation presumes that notice has been made. The statute of limitation that says you have a time to respond from notice of the action, but if there's no notice of the action, the time bar hasn't begun. I would be able to argue that until ROA on its own initiative inquired as to why it hadn't received a tax statement, it had no notice. We could have argued that the time statute of 1 year was met because we filed this action well within the time period to which we became noticed. We became notified of the action, but you're raising a very important point, and I appreciate that very much, because St. Louis County is one of the counties that is an outlier in their application of the notice provision of 248. Many other counties recognize the deficiency of the status and require, the county auditor itself will require, that before a tax certificate can be recorded, that what they call a Title 45 affidavit be filed. And if the counties that use the Title 45 affidavit in recognition of the deficiencies of the notice provision, they have the auditor actually certify a statement that not only did they attempt service, but they effected service by personal service or by mail. So St. Louis County is not speaking on behalf of the state in this issue. There are other jurisdictions of the state that are recognizing the same deficiencies that we are attempting to identify here.
But unfortunately, that is not before us. I mean, we don't have a record indicating what the sort of typical practices are. You know, what we have is the complaint and the district court's order and the statute, right?
And I acknowledge that, but what I'm referring to is in the complaint and in our briefing, we do refer to the importance of Title Standard 45, which is the basis upon which the affidavit I'm discussing is relied on by certain county auditors to affect title. So it is consistent with our argument in the complaint. The deficiencies of Title Standard 45 are well known to the practicing real estate bar and well known and identified by many of the county jurisdictions that deploy the tax collection regime. And so, yes, we do believe that it is before the court in our current argument because we have relied on Title Standard 45 in our arguments, and I'm simply addressing, identifying for the court that other county jurisdictions have relied on the same argument that we are making as the basis upon which they have additional remedial requirements.
Mr. Holstead,
yes.
The problem that we're concerned with in this case. I mean the situation where a property owner, let's just say taking the complaint as true, years later found out that he no longer owns this property. I mean, couldn't that problem have been avoided if the property owner had been paying attention and realized, I haven't received, for the last year, I haven't received a statement from the county with my property tax bill. I haven't written a check for property taxes for a year or more, maybe 2 years. I need to look into that. And then, you know, go downtown and inquire, what's going on. I mean, I think the timelines are fairly generous, right? It takes a year, 3 years before any kind of deficiency would actually lead to the forfeiture. I'm looking at your client situation, but also thinking about this in a more general way, that this would not be good if people could, due to failure of the mail or whatever other reason, lose their property. But if the property owner is diligent in trying to ensure that he, she, or the company or whatever is paying property taxes, wouldn't this just never become a problem?
Well, it's true that we may question the reasons why a property owner fails to make their taxes. I've asked that same question in this particular case. I have become aware and happen to be aware that ROA, specifically Dan Ashbeck, the principal, who was going through some trying life circumstances, particularly during the forfeiture period. His wife had just been diagnosed with stage 4 lymphatic cancer and died immediately after the expiration of the redemption period. That does not justify the lack of payment on the taxes, but it does explain in part why he would not have been available to put at the forefront of his attention, you know, his property. What he did do when he recovered from his wife's passing is he made contact to my co-counsel, my brother Wayne Holston, and asked for us to verify the status of the property because he hadn't been receiving tax statements. I, as an abstractor, was asked.
And counsel, doesn't the Mennonite case that you cited to us earlier, doesn't that actually discuss that a mortgagee's knowledge of the delinquency of the payment of taxes is not the equivalent of notice of the sale?
That's not how I read Mennonite at all. The finding of Mennonite is that the mortgagee was entitled to notice because they were a party of interest.
Yeah, and if you go on past that sentence, it says, furthermore, a mortgagee's knowledge of the delinquency in the payment of taxes is not the equivalent to the notice that the tax sale is pending. So simply knowing that you're behind on your taxes does not absolve the government of giving you notice of the tax sale.
Yes. Simply being aware of a problem doesn't absolve the government's responsibility to its due process requirements. And even getting back to your point, Your Honor, we may question why somebody lets their property taxes go delinquent, but the court, even our court and our statute, requires that notice be provisioned, you know, be provided. You know, you are behind on your taxes, and we're going to take it if you don't do something about it. And then we require under our statutory regime that we're going to take it, and after we take it, you've got a little bit of time in order to deal with it, but we still require notice. The problem with our statute is that the notice is a fiction, and it's fiction by its language because it says specifically that if notice is not provided, it is not a failure to the certificate. I'm about to run out of time.
Counsel, I do have a question before
yes.
you run out of time. So the question that we've been presented with here is the constitutionality of 284.28, but a lot of what I hear you talking about is the constitutionality of the notice requirements in the same statute, which would be 281.23, I believe, is the notice statute. What is it that makes the one-year statute of limitations the correct statute for us to be analyzing with regard to the constitutionality of the notice provisions?
I have 12 seconds left, Your Honor. Do I have permission to answer?
Of course.
Thank you. Because the time limit to respond to the action presumes that notice has been given is what our argument is to the relevance of the two provisions.
So is it the fact that it absolves all jurisdictional defects? Is the fact that the statute says you can't bring a jurisdictional defect 1 year after, is that what makes this unconstitutional?
I believe the answer is yes. I'm saying it's unconstitutional because it requires acceptance of an unconstitutional premise to affect its otherwise constitutional premises.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. You will have 5 minutes for a rebuttal as well.
Good morning. Nick Campanario, and I represent the state of Minnesota and St. Louis County in this case. May it please the court, I'm going to start by answering the first question that Judge Johnson asked by saying that the statute of limitations that governs this case is the one in section 284.28 subdivision 2, which is a little bit different from the one that's in subdivision 3.
1 year after the filing of the county auditor's certificate of forfeiture.
Correct. Okay. And so that's your marker under subdivision 2. You ask yourself, when did the county auditor record the applicable certificate of forfeiture? And in this case, it's undisputed that that occurred in October 2017. Okay.
But you don't disagree that actual notice was not received before that certificate was filed?
Actual notice of expiration of redemption?
Yes.
Prior to the forfeiture?
Yes.
I know that we published that notice as required under the statute you identified, 281.23. I know that we sent that notice by certified mail to the address that everybody seems to agree is Mr. Oshbach's address, and that it was returned to sender. And also, I know that the statute only requires personal service of the notice when you're dealing with actually occupied land.
And that's
and the parcel
and
issue
that's subdivision
here,
2-3.
I don't recall what precise subdivision it is that addresses the service requirement, but it is one of the subdivisions in section 281.23.
Okay.
In this case, we're dealing with vacant land. That's why personal service was never affected.
Excuse me.
What I want to do is try to put this case, or at least this appeal, in a nutshell as I see it. We have a claim by ROA that a forfeiture and the state's title to tax forfeited land are invalid. Why? Because according to ROA, the county auditor had a due process obligation to serve notice of expiration of redemption before the forfeiture happened. Okay, that's their claim and that's their why. That's their basis for their claim. Our defense is that the action should be dismissed for failure to state a claim. Why? Because they didn't bring the action within 1 year after the certificate of forfeiture was recorded in October 2017. That's our defense and that's our why. What they're saying in response is, well, the 1 year statute of limitations in 284.28 subdivision 2 is unconstitutional. Why? I don't know. The reason I don't know is because they've never articulated the basis or the reasoning for that position. I'm not saying they haven't taken the position. They clearly have. What I'm saying is they haven't given us their why. They didn't do that in the district court, and I have to believe that that's why the district court didn't consider or decide their constitutional challenge to the statute of limitations. They haven't done it in their briefing before this court, which is limited to statements like, well, the statute of limitations is obviously unconstitutional. The statute of limitations is clearly unconstitutional. It's not obvious to me, and it wasn't obvious to this court in 2018 when it rejected a number of constitutional challenges to the statute in King.
Mr. Campanario, yes. I guess we've been talking here today with Mr. Holstead about whether he's really challenging the constitutionality of the statute of limitations or, on the other hand, the other statutes about tax forfeiture proceedings. In the district court, how would you characterize his arguments there concerning constitutionality?
I want to think about it from the same lens of positions versus explanations why for the positions. In the district court and here, I think they're taking the position that not only is the statute of limitations unconstitutional, but also the notice regime that we have under state statute for giving property owners notice of expiration of redemption is also unconstitutional. They have done a very good job. They've done it in the district court, here, briefing, argument, you name it. I know why they're saying that the notice scheme is unconstitutional. But when it comes to the unconstitutionality of the statute of limitations, that's where they've fallen short. They haven't come forward and explained their basis for that. If they do it in the next 15 minutes, I'm sorry, that's too late.
I think he said a few minutes ago that maybe I'm incorrect, the statute of limitations is unconstitutional because it requires acceptance of an unconstitutional premise. How would you respond to that?
I would need a little bit more. Now, when it comes to...
Let me ask you this. Do you think that 284.28 sort of incorporates an assumption that notice has been made, that actual notice has been made?
To the contrary, because what Section 284.28 says is we don't care what the defect is. We want to be as clear as we can. This applies to any failure, omission, error, or defect in a tax forfeiture proceeding, even if it goes to the question of jurisdiction, even if it was substantial and prejudicial.
But isn't that really the question that they're raising, is how can you say to the extent the constitutionality relates to 0.28 as opposed to 0.23, isn't part of what they're saying is you can't you can't have a statute that waives prejudicial jurisdictional defect of notice under Supreme Court case law that says you need to receive actual notice.
Is that under Mennonite?
I
mentioned Mennonite because there was a lot of discussion of it. It hasn't been cited in the briefs. Under court rules, if there was a new case to be cited at this hearing, I was to get notice of it at least 2 days ago. I did not. I don't think I've ever read Mennonite. However,
it's in the current version of the tax of the title code. That's okay. Where it's coming from.
I have to admit, I don't practice in the area of title examination. I understand that title examiners who are trying to decide what kind of title opinion they're going to issue and whether they're going to be willing to advise in favor of title insurance can be just as conservative and risk-averse as they want to be in that regard. But we don't apply title standards to decide cases. And I don't think I had ever found occasion to consult any title standard in my entire career until the old version was cited in this case. I want to address the heart of your question, though. Due process claims, that's a type of claim you can make. I didn't receive adequate notice. I didn't get an opportunity to be heard. Things of that nature. When you have a statute of limitations, the statute of limitations is going to cover all of the claims that fall within whatever category of claims is covered by the statute. There's no except for due process claims, right? There's no statute of limitations that says you have 6 years to bring X kind of action except for due process claims. At least I'm not aware of one. And in this case, not only do we have a statute that doesn't carve out an exception for due process claims, we have one that expressly says we're meaning to cover the entire waterfront, including with respect to jurisdictional defects. And it also says, look, if you have any doubts on a question, go in favor of the state. The whole point of this statute is to make tax-forfeited property marketable and to prevent it from being tied up for 4 years, 10 years, whatever the case may be. So I'm not aware of any exception to a statute of limitations that says yes, but unless you're making a due process type claim. I want to briefly address the notion that taxes have been paid, and I know that we're on the same page on this, but just to make sure it's clear for the court, in order to bring an action like this, one of the things that you have to do is pay the taxes into court. That's part of the requirements for getting off the ground in a quiet title action against the state under these circumstances. So that has been done. The taxes are in the possession of the court, and they'll be distributed, depending on how this case shakes out. The taxes have not been paid in the sense that they've been received and are in the possession of the government.
They're in escrow, in a sense?
Exactly correct.
So if the cause of action is unsuccessful, they'll be refunded to the...
Yep. That's exactly how it would work. I have 4 minutes remaining. Something that hasn't been mentioned that is worth mentioning is Section 541.024. This is the statute that ROA has said governs this case, statute of limitations-wise. This is a statute that was enacted in 1977, and it took effect on June 15th of that year. And what the statute has always said in Subdivision 5 is that it applies to real estate titles based upon or derived from certificates issued prior to June 15th, 1977. That's what it said when it was enacted. That's what it says today. That's what it has said at all times in between. And again, this case, we're dealing with a certificate of forfeiture issued in October 2017. Another thing that the statute has always said in Subdivision 1 is that no action covered by the statute shall be commenced on or after June 15th, 1978. That's what it said back in 1977, and that's what it still says today. The statute has never provided a four-year limitations period, which is how ROA has characterized it, both in the district court and again here. I'm down to 2 minutes. I will make one last point, and I will do it because I know that it's important to my fellow respondent, Elbow Lake. The last part of ROA's appeal brief is devoted to the argument that Elbow Lake's lien is invalid. And what I just want to point out here is that the validity of the lien is not at issue in this action. If you review ROA's complaint, you'll see that as far as they have a beef with Elbow Lake, it relates solely to the amount of the lien and not its validity. If you look at the notice of list pendens that was recorded by ROA in connection with the commencement of this case, you will see the same thing. It makes clear that they're seeking a judgment that would not disturb the validity of Elbow Lake's lien. And so we haven't taken a position on the validity of the lien, but I just wanted to make clear to the court that that is not an issue that has been put before the court in this action.
It seems like appellant's brief acknowledges that it's not before us right now. On page 14, it basically says if ROA succeeds in getting reversal on other issues, the case should be remanded to permit litigation on that issue.
But even that, Your Honor, is not correct. They haven't pleaded that the lien is invalid. What they've pleaded is a dispute with respect to the amount of the lien, and that's it. Are there any other questions?
I'm not seeing any.
Thank you.
Thank you. Would you like to give a rebuttal argument?
Thank you, Your Honor. Respondent says we don't care if there's constitutional violations. And he's correct. The statute doesn't care if there's a constitutional violation. We do care. And we believe this court cares if there's a constitutional violation. We know that the U.S. Supreme Court cares if there's a constitutional violation, as we refer to Mennonite and the underlying case of Mullane, where they have found that notice in an action to take person's property requires not just the fiction of notice, but actual notice. And as discussed, the issue of statute of limitations only applies if you have an effective notice and the party's aware that the time limit has responded. I'd like to additionally cite, I want to thank our respondent for mentioning King. We could not mention King because King is, though we believe King supports our position, King is an unpublished opinion, and it was our opinion that we weren't able to cite to it. But it has been suggested that the King matter supports the county's position. I don't believe it does, because the county issue, or the issue of constitutionality there, was the very constitutionality of the existence of limitation of actions. We're not arguing that it's inappropriate to have a limitation of action like King did. King argued that the limitation time was unconstitutional. The court didn't reach that conclusion because there's plenty of evidence that there is a limitation of action, a constitutionally acceptable, and we agree. We agree only, though, we to the extent that a limitation of action has to start at a time when party knows that they're subject to the jurisdiction
so
of the court.
So can I just ask, is your argument that there can be no limitations period?
Absolutely not. And I appreciate you bringing that to our attention, because that's what the finding of King was. King's argument was that there can be no constitutional action, and the respondent has suggested that King somehow supports their position. We don't believe that it does. However, now that they brought King into the action, I'm drawing to your attention that that was King's argument, and we're rejecting that argument. We're saying that we're not dismissing the constitutionality of a limitation of action. We're saying simply that a limitation can only commence upon an actual notice, and we believe
So is your argument not that the limitations period in 541.024 applies? Because that's what I thought your argument was.
Our argument is that a limitation of action can only commence upon a constitutionally based notice period that an action has commenced. Merely to say that an unconstitutional certificate, tax certificate has been issued, you've got a year, sorry you didn't know about it, but we're taking your land is a problem. And that's the problem that we're identifying. We're not arguing that upon proper notice, there's a reasonable time period not only to pay your taxes, but our statute, to the extent that it attempts to create a constitutional process, gives you time. We forgive you for not paying your taxes, partly because there's 8, 9, 10, 11% interest applied to it, so the state is compensated well for that delay. But even after the certificate is issued, we have a very appropriate statute of limitation that says once we tell you that we took the property, you've got a year to complain about it. Well, we did complain about it upon notice. Our initiation, based on the fact that we know that the county has acknowledged that there was no actual notice. The question was asked directly as to whether or not actual notice was given, and there was not a direct answer. The answer was that we provided statutory notice. We discussed in our primary brief that statutory notice is a fiction of notice because it allows publication and it allows simply mailing a certificate, even though the statute itself says you're required to have notice. But it's okay if you don't, So
Mr. Holstead, okay, I think I understand your argument better now. Is there any case law that's right on point in the effect that it says a statute of limitations does not operate if the plaintiff does not have notice of the accrual of the cause of action because of a constitutionally deficient process?
I did not find that. What I found instead was the U.S. Supreme Court saying that absent notice, the action in its entirety is unconstitutional.
We have to look at this appeal as an appeal about a statute of limitations and whether the district court properly applied it. And so, I guess what I'm, wondering is if there's case law that essentially, applies that kind of that procedural constitutional test to the application of the statute of limitations.
I'm agreeing with the respondent that we have found no case on one side of that issue or the other as to the constitutionality specifically as to that question. I have 12 seconds, if I may. I just want to draw the court's attention to Tyler versus Hennepin County, argued 2 weeks ago in Washington, where the very tax regime, I've got 4 seconds. May I complete the answer?
Go ahead and finish up your argument.
The constitutionality of the tax forfeiture regime in the state of Minnesota is under attack, not just in this matter where we're making a vain attempt, but the U.S. Supreme Court heard the Tyler versus Hennepin County, which addresses other aspects of the constitutionality of the regime. If Tyler were found favorably in favor of Tyler, the county is simply holding title to the property in trust for ROA anyway, and suggesting that that should be considered. I thank you for your time.
Thank
Tyler,
you.
Tyler is a takings case, right?
Of course, you can answer his question. Yeah.
In Tyler, Ms. Tyler vacated the property, didn't pay the taxes, lost the taxes. The total tax amount was something like $3,000. The total deficiency got to be $25,000 with penalty and interest. Tyler does not dispute the $25,000. The county turned around and sold it for
$40,000. The constitutional theory, I think, is under the takings clause.
The constitutional theory is that the state has a legitimate interest in collecting its taxes but not profiting from the collection of its taxes, which I'm suggesting is analogous here. The county has a legitimate interest in collecting the taxes owed from ROA but doesn't have an interest in profiting from that taking. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. And thank you both for your arguments.